This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here again with Richard Register. He is an urban theorist, ecologist, advocate of eco-cities, and director of Eco-City World. Richard, great having you back on the show.
Thank you.
Richard, you've done a lot of research on the issues of rising sea levels, and you've done particular research on the San Francisco Bay Area and how to adapt to rising sea levels in particular.
Right. Well, I've actually done a lot of research in New Orleans and in reading quite broadly on ecological city design. And I went to New Orleans after Katrina and got the idea that where I'd seen people succeed after storms and after floods was in the Mesopotamian Valley. And in the first cities that ever existed on the planet, they rose up on artificial mounds of earth. And so when the floods would come, nobody would get hurt. No property would be damaged seriously and so on. The floodwaters would simply move around the little town. The small cities is what they were, that are up on top of a small hill. And so you just walked up the hill a little bit, like 20 feet above the floodplain, the agricultural land would be covered with water and silt, and then the water would go away in a couple of days, and you'd go back to farming, and nobody was hurt, nobody had to pay insurance for floods and so on. So it's a really good solution, but what's most interesting about this particular solution for places like the Bay Area or anywhere else in the world where seas are rising or where you have inland floods even, like say in the Mississippi Valley, what you can do in a place like that is to rise up on a mound of earth, but you can't do that for suburbia. You can't do that for an automobile infrastructure because it covers such a vast landscape. But when you're dealing with, say, the apartment scale of development instead of the single-family home with lots and yards and sidewalks and driveways and streets for everybody all over the place over a vast area, you can't raise that up. So the interesting thing mostly is to put together the idea of elevating a little bit on a hill, artificial fill, and building on that in a compact pedestrian sort of way. In other words, much more like an apartment way of building instead of a single family home. So that's the basic idea, and I've worked that up in a lot of drawings and written a few articles on the subject, and we have a project in Eco-City World, which is to encourage that kind of development in the Bay Area. And we call that the Bigger Bay Ecotropolis concept, because the bay is going to be getting bigger as the waters come up anyway. So it's a good time to actually create some small hills around the periphery of the bay and build ecologically healthy, very compact pedestrian communities on that. And they could be villages, small towns, maybe eventually a downtown, a few downtowns would be like fairly dense ecological cities, but you'd also have little neighborhood centers turning into, over the years, little islands, actually literally islands in some cases, if the water comes up as predicted, say, by the end of the century. By then, some neighborhoods would be flooded, but if you actually started reshaping so that you were building compact development that's pedestrian on top of these little hills, then you would be quite safe.
Are we past the tipping point of no return where sea level rise is inevitable?
I don't think so. You know, I think there's a lot of strange thinking going on out there. I think the scientists basically are very correct. You know, the temperature is rising. I visited glaciers that are retreating like crazy. I mean, this is simply happening. The place is warming up, and there is an enormous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And people have known for over 100 years now that CO2 actually collects, you know, warms up the atmosphere. And so it's a well-established science, whether Trump believes it or not. But sometimes they say things, and even the scientists will say, well, you know, CO2 will be in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. You know, lots of CO2 in the atmosphere once it's there. I don't think that's actually true. I mean, there'll be some CO2 in the atmosphere that's in the air right now in a million years from now. But in the meantime, there are all these balances going on where CO2 is being lifted into the air from transpiration of plants, from degeneration of organic material in the soil, and oxidation like that are actually producing CO2. And so that's one thing that's going on, but there are many, many forces in nature that take oxygen out of the, take CO2 out of the air and put it in the soil, and in the sediments of the planet. So if you look at how you can deal with that, you can start taking more and more CO2 out of the atmosphere and bringing it into the plants, down into the roots, into the soil, and in some cases, like on the peatlands, the carbon that goes into the peat can stay there and build up forever. It can get to be many inches deep, many feet deep, hundreds of feet deep. In fact, that's where the oil and the gas and the coal have come from. The fossil fuels come from exactly that kind of a balance where more and more is going into the soil and staying there because of various reasons that have to do with the deposition of the sediments. So anyway, there's a very good book on that called Drawdown by Paul Hawken. It's a fairly new book, came out about a year and a half ago or 2 years. And it shows you all sorts of ways you can take carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil and into the sediments. And there are all sorts of practices that help that happen. So I think you actually have to look into that very deeply and figure it out. And then you discover that that you don't have to accept that there's going to be the same amount or a worse amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. You can actually reverse that.
So with the Bay Area, there are low-lying areas, especially the areas that where they filled in the bay for development, but overall the Bay Area has a much wider variety of topography and higher elevations. Would you say that the Bay Area, and also LA to some degree as well, are at advantages over low-lying places such as New Orleans, which is probably the most vulnerable, and New York and Miami?
Well, there's a slight slope here, and it's a bit of a slope, though, whereas it's much flatter in Florida, much flatter in Louisiana. In fact, New Orleans is below sea level about, I think it's probably about 60% of it is actually protected by dikes. And I think you're probably going to have to, I mean, the carbon's going to be building up in the air for some time, but we can actually reverse that and start taking more carbon out of the air. So there will be a problem of the water going up for quite some time, but we can reverse that if we get working on it and avoid the really high rises in the water. But the slope is such here that we wouldn't be gaining an area of the land on the bay enormously, whereas in a place like Florida, you'd be losing millions of acres because it is so flat. But still, wherever you are going to get flooding because of the rise of the seas, it's a good place to think in terms of running a model where you'd actually build ecological communities. We call them eco-cities, eco-towns, and eco-villages. And you can do that on the fringe of the bay now and let the water come up. It's going to come up. You can't stop it. But you can slow it, and then eventually you can turn it around. Probably take 100 years or more. But you have to think far into the future. It's taken over 100 years to double the CO2 in the atmosphere, almost double it anyway. And we're headed in that direction rapidly, but we can head in the other direction. It'll probably take quite a while to do that, too. the solution, in my mind, is putting these two elements together. The ecological city design, which is pedestrian, works with bicycles and transit and, and walking environments, you know, a lot of variety close together, and using the elevated fill at the same time. And you don't have to cover a lot of area with your elevated fill if it's a compact pedestrian community.
There's a project with a team of designers called All Bay Coalition, and it's a competition to design these communities. You've written about this. Are you personally involved with this project?
No, it was a competition, and 9 different teams were selected, and they came up with studies and had recommendations. And that particular one was talking about San Leandro area, where there's going to be flooding as the water comes up. And that's an area that's actually inland a little bit from the Oakland airport. But it's very low line, and there's a bay there, and the bay is going to be getting deeper and deeper. And they come up with a suggestion for what to do with the freeway there and how to preserve the development without moving out of the area, which I think is very, very strange and makes absolutely no sense. They're saying, put the freeway under the water. This is, to me, a stunning and bizarre thought. When you're dealing with the Bay BART system, Bay Area Rapid Transit, you have a rather narrow, low-ceiling train that goes through 2 tubes that go under the bay straight from one high-density area to another, from Oakland to San Francisco. So that's a relatively small tube. But you talk about a freeway, and a great big freeway it's about 8 times as wide as a train track. For the amount of volume you're carrying. Plus, it's a very high-volume corridor, I-880. And not only that, but it has to have a high ceiling to get trucks through there. So the idea of burying along the East Shore Highway there underground and under the water, you know, actually digging in and letting the water go over a giant tube is, to me, one of the strangest ideas I ever heard of. I think it would be hundreds of billions of dollars to apply that around the bay. And the whole point of this competition was to come up with ideas that could be applied around San Francisco Bay. And so to me, it's just totally bizarre. It's almost an unbelievable thing to be promoting. But a group of people actually did do that for this area around San Leandro.
So with that freeway they're talking about, the I-880, that whole stretch of waterfront that goes from Oakland through Emeryville to West Berkeley, it's not just the freeway, there's also an Amtrak line, and maybe BART, I'm not sure, but if you just think about it, I mean, that project would cost, as you said, hundreds of billions, but are there other ways to open up all that waterfront property? Because it basically creates a dead zone between the cities of Oakland, Emeryville, and Berkeley, and the waterfront of the bay.
Well, as you pointed out, the land does slope up gently. I mean, it's not super flat like it is in Florida and some other places around the country, or even in inland in the Mississippi Valley where it's very flat. But, you know, it's inland, and the gradient of the water flowing down the Mississippi is very shallow. And it takes a long, long way to go down a foot if you're going down the Mississippi. But around here, it's a little steeper slope than that, so it's not going to flood anywhere near as severely, but along the edge of the water here, there will be some flooding. And if it comes up 3 feet or so, you're dealing with some pretty serious flooding, so you're going to have to build up to get ready for that. Now, they actually are getting ready for that higher water, but it's mostly been fought through as stormwater in Treasure Island. They're actually building on mounds of earth out there, right in the middle of the bay. And the new development there is going to be several feet higher than it was before, getting ready for, you know, higher water from storms mostly, but a little bit has been fought through in terms of rising seas. I think they should be going higher, but what you do is you just dredge and put the mud and the sand on the surface, and the water goes down to the water table, and some of it evaporates upward. Then you compact it, and they're using great big powerful compactors. They're either from Korea or China, I forget which, that vibrate and compact the sand and the mud and everything so it becomes quite solid down deep. and then they can put pilings deep into that, and they become pretty secure for securing larger buildings. But you can do that on a much smaller scale for villages, for little town centers, and a lot of other things, like, you know, even downtowns if they were new. You're going to have to put dikes around the high-density stuff. You're not going to be moving San Francisco, and you're not tearing it down either and replacing it all at once. But where you do have growth and where you have neighborhoods that are low-density, you can pull up all that housing that covers thousands of acres, really, and cover dozens of acres instead, and then you can actually do the elevated fill in the compact pedestrian development. And you find that works with on-foot transportation, a lot of variety of things closer together. And it works with bicycles and from one point to another, like from a village to an eco-town to an eco-city center, you can have transit. And that can be above ground, and it doesn't have to be in a gigantic tunnel holding, you know, the I-880 freeway. It's just a very bizarre idea.
So with downtown San Francisco, that would obviously need a dike because that's a very densely populated area and it's relatively small in square miles. But there's just countless areas throughout the bay. A lot of them are pretty much industrial or warehouse districts that are, some of them have, there's wetlands, and then you have some warehouses. So it's actually a really amazing opportunity to create some amazing communities in places that basically right now are just like warehouses and office parks.
Well, I think that's true. Yes, I agree.
With the whole concept of damming the bay at the Golden Gate to deal with rising sea levels, and say there was like a lock in there for ships to come through, and you had a dike in the Golden Gate, is that viable, or would that bring about tremendous ecological problems?
I think it is so bizarre. I mean, I don't know how anybody could actually think that through. What happens, and they do this already in certain parts of the world, like there's a big dam, movable dam called a barrage on the Thames River in London. And you can keep out the really high water. Like say you have a flood tide and the storms are blowing water and the tide is going to be high anyway, so suddenly the tide is 6 feet higher. Well, okay, so you can dam that off, and then you go back to normal. But if the normal is several feet higher than it is now anyway, there's no way you're going to have that the inside of San Francisco Bay at the same level in the whole ocean, averaging 3 or 4 feet higher or something. And what are you going to do? You're going to take the whole San Joaquin River and the Sacramento River and the whole water that's flowing through there, you let flow through at the same speed, and you have gigantic pumps to pump water out and into the ocean over the dam. I mean, that's crazy. You have this big basin in there, it's going to fill with water. I mean, there are big rivers flowing into this thing. You know, the whole Sierra runoff and the runoff of the east side of the coastal range are all coming down into the Bay Area, and then it goes out the Golden Gate Bridge. So you're going to pump that and try to maintain the kind of level we have here while the ocean goes up several feet. That's a nuts idea, too. I mean, it made no sense when I saw some designs for that in 2009 that actually got prizes in a competition called, I think it's called Rising Tides Competition, and it can't happen. I mean, it's just so illogical. It just boggles the mind. As I said, you can stop the super high floods now if they aren't too much higher. But when you have whole rivers pouring into a bay, you'd have to pump the water out and over the edge to actually keep the bay level at approximately the same level that it is now. So that doesn't make any sense at all.
Is this similar to that plan for Venice, Italy, which already is experiencing trouble with flooding?
Yeah, it's the same problem there. The lagoon, the Venice Lagoon there, you can keep out the really high floodwaters and the wind is blowing up the Adriatic and pushing the water into the Venice Lagoon. You know, if the water averages a certain height and then you block it off and the water in the ocean is going up an extra couple of feet, you know, you can keep that water out. But you can't keep it out forever because even in Venice, there are rivers pouring into the lagoon. And it's just going to be below sea level. So the only that you can do with Venice is put a very tight dam around it ultimately to keep the water from flowing there, which is going to wreck an awful lot of nice things about it. So, but, you know, the main issue here is you don't accommodate it. You don't adapt to it. When you started this interview, you said I was going to be talking about adaptation. Well, I'm really not. I think we adapt only a little bit as things change, but we try to stop it. The interesting thing about ecological city design and planning is that you actually don't cause the problem in the first place because you don't have all those cars. You have an environment where people can bicycle. You have compact development that saves energy and heating and cooling in all your buildings instead of scattering them out over a flat surface over vast distances. You don't need all the asphalt and concrete. You know, making concrete produces enormous amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. And so here you have the big buildings in Oakland that they're building right now, and these things consume an enormous amount of concrete, and you look at them and you notice, wait a minute, there's a tower that's 22 stories just one block from my house that's being built right now, and the tower is one-third of the width of the parking structure underneath. In other words, the first four floors are all parking for the cars, but the tower is only one-third as wide. That means that if you figure you would have the cars on the same footprint as the place where the people live, you know, it would be 12 stories of parking. You know, and so you here the building is 40% given over to parking, and that's a lot of concrete, and that's a lot of CO2 produced. And it's requiring all those cars. It's built so that people are encouraged to use cars, and they have a magnificently gigantic impact also. So, you know, an enormous amount is saved in terms of climate change by doing the eco-city design. And the thing that's really kind of exciting to me, actually, about building on elevated artificial soil is that it fits perfectly with two things. It adapts a little bit while you let the water come up, but it starts figuring out how we can live so we don't create the problem in the first place. And then even beyond that, you realize you can take carbon out of the atmosphere through various natural processes that you can help, like don't cut down the forest, raise cattle and things on grassland so that more carbon goes into the soil. There are peatlands all over the world, and peat will keep gaining more and more and more carbon out of the atmosphere forever. It can get hundreds of feet deep. You know, it takes a long, long time to do that. But you can design things so with just a little bit of leverage, you can take enormous amounts of carbon out of the air and start stopping the problem. And the biggest thing you can do to stop the problem of climate change is to build an ecologically tuned city.
As far as building communities on elevated fill, you're talking primarily within the bay itself. Is this also viable in places right in the Pacific Ocean, say Santa Cruz, Monterey, Carmel, and where I live in Santa Barbara?
I'm not suggesting to build in the actual bay. You might have a little bit of that going on, but basically we're going to see flooding. So you start mounding up dirt in an area that's very low-lying, and the water will come up around it. The bay will actually be getting bigger. I'm not advocating going into some area where the water is deep and building big mounds of earth and then trying to protect them. I'm concerned with the water rising into neighborhoods that are very thinly developed, and that's not a good idea. You're going to have to withdraw from that. You're going to have to face up to flexible planning so that people can move somewhere else when they're about to be flooded. You have thousands and thousands of acres around the bay in low-density development. And if it's not low density, if it's like, say, San Francisco or Oakland or even like, you know, parts of Berkeley a little more dense or whatever, I mean, you can put that on a much, much smaller footprint, and therefore you don't have to use an enormous amount of earth to raise it up a little bit. So, you know, you have to look at the landscape to get a good idea of what you're actually dealing with. I'll give you one example that I think is really interesting, which is that in 1900, the worst natural disaster in terms of loss of life in the United States happened with a hurricane that hit Galveston, Texas. And after that hurricane, they built up Galveston about 22 feet higher on average. they pumped a slurry of mud from the Galveston Bay onto this small spit of land, essentially, which is where the city of Galveston was built. And they raised the whole city about 20 feet, 22 feet, something like that on average. And with buildings that had survived, and about half the city's buildings were totally destroyed, but the ones that survived, they put on jacks and they raised them up, manually operated screw jacks. This is 1900. And they raised them up about 25 feet, and they built, they poured this mud onto the surface, and it kept getting higher and higher and drying out. Water would go down into the water table, which was about sea level there, and dry out. And they built foundations on top of that, and the buildings now are sitting in the air about 3 feet above the foundations. They just lowered the buildings on the foundations that are now 20 feet higher. So they solved their problem of flooding. They have a big storm wall there to keep out the gigantic waves and the big storms, and they have wind damage, and they have a little bit of flooding and heavy, heavy rains. But the hurricanes since then have not torn the place to pieces like that. So that's an extremely successful example. And if you actually add to that the more compact pedestrian design, it's even more efficient, and it takes less land to raise up your design and get away from the floods.
The last time we talked about your book, Eco City Berkeley, your work with urban planning in Berkeley and barriers to change there. Were you involved with any projects that or had any visions to revitalize the waterfront as an eco city? Because right now the Berkeley waterfront, that area is, well, as I mentioned earlier, has the freeway, and it's also fairly industrial.
Well, the if you go as a regional plan or a state plan or national plan or whatever, if you think big and you're not just dealing with one property at a time or one building at a time, you can start seeing enormous changes. For example, right now, everybody thinks in terms of, well, you're just going to have everybody going down the freeway forever, but you don't have to. Everybody could be taking transit, and the transit could be built a little bit farther inland, or it could be up on a causeway kind of a thing and be much smaller than this great big wide freeway. And so you could open up the landscape by the waterfront like that. You could also take the city dump area that is now that peninsula that sticks out there with the marina and everything, and you could build on top of that with proper ceiling and that sort of thing, put a little town out on the island there, and it is elevated already. Anyone who goes out there can experience the nice rolling hills and everything. And so in places like that that are already there, you could build on that and have something that houses quite a few people. Once again, I'm not suggesting that we build in the bay as a major idea, but around it in a way so that as the water comes up, you're above the water that's coming up. And the most important thing, once again, is that you're building in a way that doesn't cause that problem in the first place. But the other problems you solve is if it's more an ecotropolis. In other words, we live in a metropolis that's basically built around the automobile. But if we lived in an ecotropolis, a matrix of ecological cities, towns, and villages at all these different scales, then transit works really well with that. Because on average, we have very, very low density in the American way of building, which has gone around the whole world and become, with the automobile infrastructure, the most damaging thing going in terms of climate change and species extinction on the planet. So you discover all sorts of very interesting alternatives for design for living places in the what you might think of as sort of the palette of opportunities for designing compact, very livable, very cozy and interesting, and sometimes tall and a lot of times not so tall, but much more varied sort of landscape for people to live in.
And the last time we talked, we sort of discussed how a lot of places that exist have the puzzle pieces of these attributes, but the key is like putting all these puzzle pieces together, because none of them really exist in like its true fruition.
Well, there's no really complete eco-city anywhere, and the features that are developing that work with the eco-city are good, and they're all over the world. but they're in most cases a fairly minor part of the total mix. Now, it's not true everywhere, because some places, some of the pieces that make sense with eco-cities are doing quite well, like Germany and Denmark, for example, with their wind and solar. But that's just the energy source. How do you run the whole thing? And then you find, well, in the European compactness, your average city over there, even though it has quite a few cars in it, nonetheless runs on about a third the energy for and land, as the cities in the United States are even more efficient. Now, they're already contaminated by automobiles, with lots and lots of cars and lots of automobile infrastructure, even in Europe, and in places where the cities are much better in terms of transit and so on. So if you imagine taking even more cars out of their situation and opening up some landscapes in the areas that are low density in European cities, and there are quite a few. Like, I went to Barcelona once, I decided to take the transit system out into the low density areas, and the low density areas are much more, much bigger than the higher density areas of Barcelona. You know, all over the world you have the old density pedestrian nodes that are really quite small relative to what's happened because of the automobile. And in the United States, of course, the cores are pretty dense. Like, you have the core of San Francisco, and you have, you know, New York City with Manhattan and so on. But you get out into Long Island, and you get out into San Jose, and and way up towards Santa Rosa and everything, and people are living scattered out like crazy. The average is very low density, and it could be very pedestrian and very, very nice design. So there's a lot of options out there.
When I was in Europe recently, I did notice that they do have suburbia outside Vienna and Milan, but it's nothing comparable to what you see in the United States.
Yep, that's true.
Are they heading in our direction, or do you think they're heading in the right direction in Europe?
I think they're probably heading in the right direction in a lot of the projects I hear about, but then, you know, people send me information. I read generally on things that are moving in an eco-city direction. It's interesting, though, that if you go to China, and I've been to China on 25 different trips, I've done a lot of speaking there at universities and you know, gone to a lot of planning meetings of various city planning departments and things like that in China. And there, they're developing car dependence with high density, you know. And so you have big parking structures, you have incredibly crowded ring roads in Beijing, you have five or six ring roads now, and they're probably going to be building another one. And so the car is taking over, but their problem is they have very high density, but they also have a very great distance between many of the things they're building, because as time has been going on, they're designing for more and more mobility. Individuals really want cars over there. For example, I was in a taxi once with a Chinese fellow in the back seat, and we were saying, well, what do? I work on this and that and so on. And then I mentioned I work with ecological cities, and we think bicycles and transit are really good and so on, and we think cars create a really big problem. And so this fellow says, well, if I can't have a car, how can I get a wife? And he was absolutely dead serious that, you know, it's that much in everybody's life over there. It, just like it was in the United States back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And so they're a very high population country, and they have a tradition of very big public open spaces that go back to the various empires and their grandioseness. And they have gigantic big buildings, but they don't have the fine grain, or in most places anyway, they don't have the fine-grained mixed use as developers, a fine-grained mixed use as the planners use that term. End up driving these vast distances just like Americans, and yet they're dense instead of spread out.
A lot of this development in mainland China is fairly new. How have places in Asia that are more established, such as Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Singapore, and South Korea, done in regards to creating car-free cities?
Well, I don't actually know those particular countries you mentioned that well. I've never been to Japan, for example, which is odd because it's the first place, first foreign country to actually print one of my books in Japanese. It was, of all books, Eco City Berkeley. You know, and they're pretty far removed from Berkeley, but somebody really wanted to print it over there. But in any case, I don't know these countries that well. I know China, India, you know, most of the South American countries, North America and Europe pretty well, a little bit of Africa, but I actually don't know Japan and some of these other big cities. I've been to a place like Hong Kong. That's been a city for quite a while. Not super ancient. I mean, the British built it up, and so it goes back, 150 years or so in its, you know, heavy development. But I don't have an enormous amount of knowledge about those places. I do think, though, that it's pretty rare when you get the pieces together. Curitiba, Brazil was very good about that for many years, but they have slowly spread out nonetheless, even though they had some of the most leading projects, and they're still pretty good. They have a lot of pedestrian areas. They have their floodwaters come up there and create sort of lakes in the parks. So the water goes into the soil. They have mini parks everywhere. They have 24-hour open streets for young people to hang out, and there are pedestrian streets and so on. But they've gained more and more cars as time has gone on, too. So there's places that have good elements, like there's car-free areas that are growing in some cities. Amsterdam was going to have car-free areas that were growing rapidly, and they just couldn't pass the laws to actually make it be rapid, but there are some areas that are becoming actually car-free. Berkeley has absolutely not one street that's car-free, not a single one in the whole city, and yet they think they're very green. Oakland has a few pedestrian streets right around City Hall that are very, very short. There's not much there. But in Europe, you have some areas with fairly large areas now that are becoming car-free. So that's good. But the pieces are everywhere. And when they're just pieces. For example, one of the things you can do is have attached solar greenhouses and terracing, so that as the building goes up, it's set back, and you have the use of the surface areas. This you find all over northern India, by the way. And in Nepal and Bhutan and other places, the people use terracing and look out over the landscape from rooftops, which is pretty neat. I was just in the Galapagos, and they design like that down there. And they have an ecological element, you might say, in that they have sun directly overhead. And so one of the things they do is have lots of roofs floating over the buildings. And they have a lot of terraces, and all the terraces have roofs protecting people from the sun. And so you see this horizontalness of these taller buildings that step back like a ziggurat, more or less, like a pyramid. And you get beautiful views from up there. You have very interesting architecture and a lot of variety. And you have a lot of shade worked right into it. So things like that are pretty good, and they're scattered. In the Galapagos, a lot of the buildings are like that, though. It's actually rather concentrated there. It's a very good design idea. So different places, but I think around the world in general, we're still very, very dominated by the automobile. I mean, enormously so, and that's most of the problem in terms of CO2 buildup and, you know, a lot of other things about living with the automobile.
Yeah, what you were saying about the Galapagos is really fascinating, how most of the islands are ecological preserves, and they have this very small area that's very compact and walkable. Do you see places, other national parks like Yosemite National Park, where you have people staying in these hotel complexes, lots of forest and open space in between, some areas that are fairly walkable, and then a tram system? Would you say that Yosemite has aspects of a model for an eco-city?
A little bit, but not much. There's an interesting book by a fellow. Why am I blanking on its name right now? I have it in here somewhere. It's called YV88, and it's about taking a train, and you know, a very small light train, sort of like a BART train or something, into Yosemite Valley, called YV88, and. Boy, his name isn't even on the cover of his book. Okay, I was saying that there's a book by Christopher Swan, and it's called YV88, and it had some really good ideas about getting into and how to organize the area of Yosemite. And he's suggesting a train that's rather like a sort of a very glassy, you know, you can see around this train as you move across the landscape.
So it would get rid of cars completely?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be, you have a center there, instead of a big parking lot, you go in on this little train, which I think is a very neat idea.
Did he talk about the model of lodging?
No, and I don't know much about it. I've never actually stayed in there before. He talks about it, but I haven't read his book in many years. I'm looking at it right now, though, while you're talking.
Are there other national parks you've been to that have done a better job?
Well, I haven't really studied national parks that well, I mean, I visited a few of them, but they look like nice hotel developments and so on. But once again, there's this, in a swamp of automobiles, most of them.
With the whole freeway issue, so obviously putting freeways underground is not at all viable, and it would cost hundreds of billions. Is building mounds of, say, like an artificial hill over a highway or freeway, is that viable?
Over a highway or freeway?
Yeah.
Well, you can do it. I mean, you can have tunnels with traffic going under. In fact, they actually have that, and I treat it as sort of a joke in my book, Eco City Berkeley, the first place I had an illustration like that, where I imagined a freeway underground. And it's actually built in Vienna. On the other side of the Danube from Vienna is a place called United Nations City. And there's a lot of United Nations offices and people live there and so on. And there's some pedestrian bridges that go up the Danube. But there's a highway that runs along the side of the river on the far side from Vienna. And that they put underground. And the way they did that was to build a big bridge over it, essentially, that goes on and on for 2.5 miles. But it's pretty expensive, and it isn't a gigantic arterial the way the one of I-880 is. It's a smaller freeway, and it's very expensive, but it's very, very dense there, and it runs a fairly short distance. But if you were to try to ring the whole bay with all the places where the water is going to come up, close to where the transportation systems have been built on the lowlands, then you're dealing with an absolutely gigantic project, much bigger than the one that I saw in Vienna, which looked almost exactly like my drawings. I didn't know anything like that existed at the time. I imagine these sort of skylights that were little boxes that rise up made out of concrete with the air, flowing over and down into the area where the freeway is, but there'd be these walls about 9 feet high around the opening so that people wouldn't fall in, And that is exactly what they did. They just created this absolutely gigantic bridge 2.5 miles long, essentially, that the highway goes under there at a very high price. That too.
I noticed that they have a lot of wind farms from the outskirts of Vienna all the way up north to the Czech border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's coming in big in Europe, so that's good. I mean, it's also, overdue almost anything, I think. For example, if you go up to Rio Vista, I think it is in that area, up the Sacramento River and look around, there's some vast areas of growing wind farms, and, beyond a certain amount, you start saying, wouldn't it be smarter just to use a lot less electricity in the first place? To be more conservative about it, even the wind farms and even the solar energy sources, I mean, they're far, far better than burning fossil fuels for sure, but conservation is the first order of business as far as I can see, and the biggest piece of conservation is designing the city so that it doesn't run on automobiles, asphalt, concrete, gasoline, and so on.
And yeah, I also noticed that Vienna actually is it's not as spread out as an American city, but it's a little bit spread out by European standards. But if you go to the central part of Prague, basically the entire center is extremely compact and walkable.
Mm-hmm. That's what I've heard. I've never been there, though.
You mentioned that ancient civilization Ur in Sumeria, and this was built upon a floodplain. in Mesopotamia. Was this
Euphrates rivers go through there.
On the Tigris and Euphrates or in between?
Well, it's on both sides of them, and of course the two rivers run parallel, so the whole valley there is pretty flat. And in fact, it's very marshy. They had a long history of living on marshes there. It's pretty fantastic, and there's still a little bit of that going on.
Was the city of Ur, was it fairly dense and compact? What was the estimated population?
Well, the estimates that I've read are between 10 and 30,000, so it was like a, you know, substantial town. But they qualify it as a city in that it had a whole variety of different kinds of functions going on simultaneously. An earlier town I visited, it's a ruin, and it's covered in, you know, mostly it's a mound of earth, and only at the time 6% excavated is Çatalhöyük. And Çatalhöyük is in Turkey, and it's 8,000 years old, whereas Ur is, 4,500 years old. So that's really, really old, but all the buildings are almost identical, and they didn't have specialized buildings like churches and workshops and living quarters and manufacturing places and, you know, bakeries or whatever. But by the time you get to Ur, these specialized structures were happening. At Çatalhöyük, people had their little zones in their house where they would do all sorts of different things. Every person was sort of a little city unto themselves, you might say, because they would have a worshiping corner in one part of the room. They'd have a place where they'd work in their crafts on a table or on the floor or something. They'd have a sleeping area. They'd have something that amounts to a little kitchen. They wouldn't have a restaurant. They wouldn't have a church. They wouldn't have a lot of things that a city has in variety. So much less specialization. So a lot of people say, well, Çatalhöyük really wasn't the first city. Ur is much more like a city. And that's probably a pretty good definition.
What are some of the potential ecological impacts of rising sea levels on the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta? And are some of these ideas viable there as well?
If you're going to have people living there, you'd want to be putting them on mounds. The highways, of course, the roads up there are on elevated berms. I mean, they're on top of dikes, basically. And it's very freaky, and people who travel up there will notice that the river is much higher than the land around them. It used to be very, very rich in terms of wildlife, too, of course, with all the billions of birds that would come through there and all the marshes and everything. And islands were created, and then oddly, as they dried out and gases would go up into the air, same thing happened in New Orleans, the landscape actually sinks because there's a lot of chemical action and a lot of material is leaving as gases and compacting. So the river is much higher there than the landscape around it. You see that also in Holland and places like that. But in any case, probably the sensible thing to do there is to simply let the water come back where it was and not build in suburban sprawl, because a lot of that suburban sprawl is taking over land that used to be agricultural. And that's one of the phenomena a lot of people don't think too much about, but cities have spread out over the best of the agricultural land because they were established where the food growing was relatively easy. So we've wrecked most of our agricultural areas that are anywhere near the larger cities by paving over. I mean, down in San Jose and that area, the South Bay, it used to be just wonderful orchards and everything, Santa Clara and all that. And now it's everywhere developed in a very thin layer.
Yeah, I've heard that region, that section of the Central Valley adjacent to the Bay Area, is one of the fastest growing sprawl areas in California.
Well, there's quite a... Yeah, I know. It shocked me that it's become quite exurban, in other words, not just suburban, but way up into the natural areas. For example, I've flown into the Bay Area for many years, and I began to realize I didn't know where I was coming in after twilight, because I'd look down, I'd expect to see the lights of of maybe Livermore and in the bay in the distance and so on. But there were lights all over the place. And then I realized what was going on is that there's development all the way up into the foothills of the Sierras, where thousands and thousands of people are living, scattered extremely thinly in this exurban living situation. It's gigantic. The same thing you fly out of Newark, for example, in New Jersey, head out towards western Pennsylvania and New York, New York State. And at night, it looks like it's all lit up. It goes on for miles and miles like that. In the daytime, you see trees everywhere, but that's because the suburbs and the development, the asphalt, the concrete, the driveways and everything are all under the trees. You don't see them, but they're there. So the sprawl is even much bigger than you think it is. And then the evening comes and all the street lights light up. And then you got that effect that you see from space, where the populated countries of the world, like most of Europe and eastern United States and so on, is just a bright light into the sky at night. There's so many people scattered over such a large distance.
Within the Bay Area itself are places like southern Santa Clara Valley and the inland parts of Alameda and Contra Costa County and even into Marin and Sonoma. Are those places also vulnerable to suburban sprawl?
Well, I mean, they're as vulnerable as people want to keep having cars. Yeah, I mean, if people who are now taking transit all wanted to shift to cars, it would become much more vulnerable. I think basically we're at a point where things are shifting, and people are beginning to realize, kind of late in history, that there are better ways of dealing with the automobile than buying them and making room for them. You find, as you read lots of literature, that people don't want to come right out and say the automobile is a really big, horrible problem. You know, it's destroying so much, not just the landscape and conviviality and public spaces that people enjoy, but it's also changing the climate of the whole planet, and it's driving species extinct. And these things are absolutely gigantic problems. But you always see it referred to in a very gingerly sort of way. They say alternative transportation, like, you know, bicycles and transit and walking and even skateboards and these new little scooters that people have these days. You know, that's all alternative transportation. As if, hey, wait a minute, alternative to what? Why don't you just say the car sucks? You know, it's really screwing up the shape of the cities, the climate of the planet, driving species extinct in these exurban areas where people live in very low density. You can't fight fires in areas like this because there are people everywhere in little houses and fire zones. I mean, people shouldn't be living out there. And if they were to live out there, they should live in compact little centers where you have a couple of swimming pools, you have apartment-style building instead of single-family homes, so it's all clustered together. And then you can defend from a fire because you're taking up 1/20th of land area. I have drawings like this that show how you can take a whole area of hundreds of acres and turn it into a couple little villages of sort of European density. You don't even have to go to really high density. And then the fire winds almost always come from the same general direction. And so you have a swimming pool or two upwind from where the fire is going to be coming from. And you have gasoline pumps and you have water hoses and nozzles, and you know, you raise up what's called a curtain of water for about 20 minutes or a half hour. And as the fire front goes by, you protect it. And then the fire front is gone, and then you're safe. And so you can build like that, but nobody wants to talk about it because it's radically different than the way we're already doing it. In fact, I've written articles, or rather opinion pieces, for the San Francisco Chronicle, and they just won't take them. They say, oh, we're not experts on stuff like that. Well, your readers aren't experts on it either. Let's just think about it.
So, yeah, that was a huge issue. We had a massive fire here in Santa Barbara, the Thomas Fire, and people are basically rebuilding their homes and in these very high-prone fire zones. But basically, what you're advocating is retrofitting these suburban areas into instead of a car-oriented suburbia, it would be these compact little European model villages surrounded by open space.
Yep, that's basically it. and they're very defensible. And you find out even in Europe, where they've had some disastrous fires this year also, you might note, that the areas where the fires are most damaging is where it's in areas that are thinly developed. And if you have higher density development, you can marshal more people, more firefighters, more water, more everything closer together to fight the fire. And when you think of the difference between the exurban development around Santa Barbara, which is very thin, and in the lower Sierra foothills, and in Santa Rosa, for example, it's a very, very flat, scattered town. How do you defend something like that? It covers like 10 times or even 50 times the land area of a compact little village, which is very defensible, especially if you have, say, swimming pools. I mean, it's a great thing in California. Have a swimming pool.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, everyone needs to have their own swimming pool. There's not, like, one swimming pool for the whole neighborhood.
Right. Right. And you have a larger swimming pool if you have a lot of people using it, too, so there's a lot more water. Last longer fighting your fire. I was saying four people actually did survive in swimming pools who otherwise would have died in the Oakland Berkeley Hills fire. They hopped in their pools because they had pools, and they pulled the insulation over themselves, and they weathered the fire front long enough that they survived.
So there's that benefit from there's ecological benefit. There's the benefit of natural disasters like fires and mudslides, but not just that. It just seems much more pleasant to live in a compact village surrounded by with communal space that you can use, areas like redwoods and oak woodlands you can go out hiking in. It just seems like a much, besides, I mean, obviously it's ecologically friendly, but it seems like a much more pleasant way to live than what we have now.
Well, not only that, too, but of course there are thousands of people around the world. There are hundreds of thousands of people that die in car crashes in cities. They just outright killed. And there's millions, many millions, that are injured severely. And if you just don't have the cars there, no one's going to be getting killed by cars. You know, have a few rare accidents on bicycles where somebody dies, but not very often. And the transit accidents and so on happen, and they get spectacular coverage because they're, if you have a train with 100 people on it and 30 people die at the same time, then it's a big deal. But that's very, very rare, the number of miles driven by people in cars compared to other forms of transportation in terms of accidents. It's just cars are much worse. And if you actually have a car-free city and people take transit in the cities, and it's not really fast transit or crude, but rather like streetcars out in the streets and moving at a modest speed instead of really fast, then you have the fast ones are way out in the country somewhere where they don't interfere with people at all. But you can drop the fatality rates gigantically too. So it's a far, far safer way of getting around to not have the cars.
Richard, we are getting close to the end of the show. Do you want to plug some of your upcoming projects? You're involved with one of your upcoming events is involving Earth Day.
Well, I'm not really involved with Earth Day yet. I'm going to be visiting with the guy who's organizing it more than anybody else, probably Dennis Hayes. He organized the first Earth Day. And I might mention that the Earth Day in 1990 was the largest human event in all of history, other than big national, the biggest of the national holidays and religious holidays. It's really big, 200 million people in 1990. And we had Dennis Hayes as our keynote speaker at the EcoCity conference that happened 2 weeks before Earth Day, as part of the whole season of Earth Day building up and everything, with Dennis as our speaker. That was back in 1990, and that was the first of 13 or 12 conferences we've had. The 13th one is going to be in Vancouver. These have been all over the world, by the way, on every continent except Antarctica. So I hope to be engaging Earth Day in a big way. I'd like to lend the EcoCity themes to Earth Day plans so that there's a focus on it, so that people would be talking more than they generally do about ecological cities and the impact of pedestrian cities being extremely small compared to automobiles and so on. So that's a big goal. Another one, plugging what I do, you might say, is I'm working in the Galapagos now, and I think it's important that people understand that evolution suggests that sprawl is a big disaster as well as ecology. And I say that in a way that, you know, a lot of people aren't into this, but I like astronomy. I like cosmology. You know, I like thinking in terms of planets developing their geology and then their biology with their lithosphere and then their hydrosphere and atmosphere producing life, the biosphere. And so if you take a big, broad view of evolution, not just biological evolution, but all evolution in the universe, you see that it's always moving in a direction that seems to be normal towards more miniaturization and complexification in smaller and smaller areas. And so, in other words, the stars that come out of the gases in the early universe are taking up much, much less space, these little points that the stars are relative to the vast clouds of gases and emptiness of space. And then these blow up, the stars blow up in supernovas and create planets. And planets are much more complex and much, much smaller than the stars. The Earth, for example, is about 1/1,000,000th the mass of the Sun. And then on the planets, life can emerge. It's emerged on this planet anyway, and it's probably on some others. And so you have this pattern. It's always going towards better integration of smaller and smaller units of complexity that's functioning in a way that becomes more and more lively, and then it turns into life, and then consciousness emerges in us. And so that's the full swath of evolution. We're right at the very front edge of evolution on our planet through all these steps towards more better ordered complexification in smaller areas, and that's very much like cities. So cities are, quote, like, I'm saying it's an analogy, cities are like complex living organisms in many, many ways. And so if you look to evolution, you begin to say, wait a minute, you know, evolution is saying sprawl is a disaster. It's scattering out and taking up much more space, and it's requiring much more material, much more energy than the compact way of building. And that is going in the opposite direction of normal, healthy evolution, as far as we can tell. So the reason I'm working on the Galapagos is to try to create a model project down there, which would build a what we call eco-city fractal. We're not building a whole town anytime soon, but you can be building a part of a town. Just a couple of blocks can become a fantastic demonstration project. So I hope that will happen in the Galapagos. And in the meantime, of course, it's got a lot of pretty fantastic things going on. Like 97% of it is wildlife entirely, wild landscape. They're only allowing 3% of the whole island to be developed for people, and that includes their agriculture, which is absolutely amazing.
That area that is developed, is it fairly dense?
It's kind of a little bit dense. For example, though it's a very small town, their largest town is Puerto Ayora, it's called. It's a very small town. It somewhere between 10,000 and 12,000 people is the figures I keep hearing. So it's not really big. It's pretty much walkable through most of the town, though they have made a mistake there about 15 years ago, and opening up an area outside of where they normally are building in that area is far enough out that people are going to be driving a lot more to get there. But there are many more bicycles there than there are cars, and basically probably 70 or 80% of all the motor vehicles you see are these little taxi-like vehicles where you have a cab in a back seat for the cab, but you also have a little short sort of a pickup truck in the back so people can actually carry small, toolboxes and gigantic shoppings and so on if they want them in the back of these trucks, these that are also like, I think they call them king cabs in the United States. But they're smaller down there. But in any case, those are public vehicles, and for $1.50, you can go anywhere in town pretty rapidly. But rapid there isn't very fast because the distances aren't great, and most of the traffic is bicycles, and the streets are actually pretty quiet. So it's pretty neat in that regard. And then there's the architecture I told you about. But the thing that I think's really exciting about it is that evolution and ecology are the same thing. And they both run on the same principles of mutation and other dynamics that you can get into when you start studying evolution. And if people people are aware that what we're part of in this universe is an evolving situation in which everything is moving and changing. We have sort of like we're in a universe of two creations, you might say, the beginning of the whole thing, whatever that was. And then there's a constantly changing and growing and developing complexification, miniaturization phenomenon going on at the same time. Well, Darwin got quite famous for very good reason, identifying these facts about evolution. And as people wake up to that more and more so, and the science is absolutely assured to be giving us good information on all this, then it's indicating that we have to build ecologically healthy cities to really solve our major problems. And so you have Darwin on your side, you have the heavy guns, you might say, you know, the really powerful ideas saying, hey, you got to start taking very seriously transforming our cities. And the last point I think I should make is that flexibility is the really big issue, flexibility and generosity, investing in building the right thing, and doing it, that's generosity. You know, you actually spend money on not just goofing off and wasting your time or counterproductive things or warfare, for that matter. You start trying to figure out how to solve your problems and reinvest in actually changing the cities we have. And that's a really big piece of the problem solved. And to get there, though, we need to have flexible thinking. You have to actually entertain the idea that, hey, you know, you can't make a better car. The better the car, the worse the city, because you keep doing the same thing over and over again. You keep sprawling out, and you say, oh, well, the car is safe. You know, here comes Ralph Nader. The car is safe, so, oh, they're okay, let's do that. Or down in Los Angeles, the air was unbreathable, and I was down there at the time, where you're just strangling on the air, and tears are going down your cheeks, and you could barely breathe, and people are actually living there. I was actually living there. I liked it culturally and for my artwork and so on. But it was a dangerous place to be, and they fixed the atmosphere by fixing the car. And so in those days, Los Angeles was unusual. It was the leading sprawl city in the world. And now they're all sprawl cities. So we cleaned up the air down in Los Angeles by improving the car, and we damaged cities disastrously in the process.
Richard Register, it has been an excellent show. So many fascinating topics. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.